Good morning. It's good to be with you. We are in Leviticus today. We started that series last week, and we are covering seven chapters today, and so we're going to get right into it. No small talk. Last week, we did our introduction, and we talked about the reason we're in Leviticus. If you missed it, Psalms tells us that the law of God is sweeter than honey. Says that it's a lamp to our feet. It shows us our way. Jesus says that he came to fulfill the law. And he says all scripture testifies about him. It's worth it for us to know Leviticus. Like, God has so much for us in his law, and we are at a loss if we avoid it and if we don't put some effort into gaining an understanding from it. And that's what we're doing. We also mentioned last week in that introduction, and if you haven't heard it, if you missed it, I do encourage you, I don't think I've done this before, but go back and listen to that one. It's just going to help you with your overall understanding of Leviticus. But the main problem that Leviticus is solving is the problem of sinful people being near to God's holy presence. Because his presence is in their midst. He's in the tabernacle in their midst, and his holiness is making that place holy, and yet these people are sinful, and how can they draw near to him with that being the way that they are? And so so that's what Leviticus solves, and we start to see how it solves it in these first seven chapters. These are instructions about five different kinds of offerings that are part of God's system of worship that's centered on the tabernacle, later the temple, and what we call the sacrificial system. And they all do something different. The five offerings, they're all used for different things. They're each a little bit unique, but the main purpose is, you know, this is what it takes and this is what it looks like to be with God. Like, to be near God's holiness, that these are the things that are required. These are the things that have to be covered. These are the things that have to be fixed. This is what it's going to be like and what it's going to look like. Now, especially if you're a visitor, if you're new to faith, but not even, you know, only that, I can feel a question or like a sense arising from people when we get to something like the sacrificial system of worship in the Old Testament, where we go like, that's strange, you know? Is a sacrificial system really necessary? Like, isn't that a little bit barbaric? Like, why do we really have to do it? And also, like, I'm so glad that we've evolved past that, you know? Like, those ancient dumb people, like, I'm so glad we're past that now, and that's not the way we do things. And to that kind of question or feeling, I'd like to say, yes, it was necessary, even though it was bloody. It is absolutely necessary, and we haven't actually evolved past it. But that's something we'll circle back to at the end. The thing is, like, you know, this feels so foreign and strange and alien to us. The Israelites worship at the altar of their God, and they bring their sacrifices to the altar of their God. How many people do you know worship at the altar of their career? They worship at the altar of their family. They worship at the altar of money. They worship at the altar of beauty. And they bring their sacrifices there. Like, that's the thing they sacrifice to, you know? We're not different. We're exactly the same. How many people will sacrifice their family to the altar of their career? You know? They're like, this is the thing that's really important to me, and this is the thing that's really fulfilling to me, and they neglect their family. How many people are going to sacrifice so much money and time and effort and all-consuming thoughts to the altar of their beauty? I need to do this to look good. I need to do this to keep my beauty. I need to do this. I need to get that. I need to have this thing done. We're not different. It's the way that we are. What people do, and this is how God has created it, we get something to worship, we make it the highest significance and priority in our hearts and in our lives, and then we live for it. We dedicate ourselves to it. We gladly bring our sacrifices to it and hope that we get from it the fulfillment that we feel is lacking in us. So just keep that in mind as we go through what these offerings are, these five offerings, and I'll ask some pointed questions along the way. But, you know, do your best to keep up with me. I've never covered this much ground in a sermon before, and so the way we're going to go about it is I'm going to read as much from the text as I think we need to get the overall understanding. But we're not going to be getting into very many details today. And just what I hope happens from this is give you the good, solid understanding about the purpose of these offerings. And so when you go and read Leviticus 1 through 7 on your own, as I'm sure everyone is doing today, you'll be equipped to get so much more from those details. You say, oh, that makes sense. Oh, I understand what this is. You see how it fits into that bigger purpose. And so that's what today is. Everyone ready? Three nods. All right, we're ready. Leviticus 1, verse 1, says this, talking about the burnt offering, also called the ascension offering. The Lord called to Moses and spoke to him from the tent of meeting, saying, speak to the people of Israel and say to them, when any one of you brings an offering to the Lord, you shall bring your offering of livestock from the herd or from the flock. If his offering is a burnt offering from the herd, he shall bring a male without blemish. He shall bring it to the entrance of the tent of meeting that he may be accepted before the Lord. He shall lay his hand on the head of the burnt offering, and it shall be accepted for him to make atonement for him. Then he shall kill the bull before the Lord, and Aaron's sons, the priests, shall bring the blood and throw the blood against the sides of the altar that is at the entrance of the tent of meeting. And then further in verse 9 ends, and the priest shall burn all of it on the altar as a burnt offering, a food offering with a pleasing aroma to the Lord. All of it is burnt. We're reading a few more of the mechanics and the details in the first offering because they get repeated for the later offerings where an animal is offered up. And so, you know, things like unblemished animal, laying your hand on the head, throwing the blood on the altar, those are things that keep getting repeated. So we're only going to read it the one time here. And, you know, laying the hand on the head, what that does is it signifies an acknowledgement, this animal is taking my place. Right, this animal is standing in my place. That's why you put your hand on the head. Unblemished animal, an animal without any faults, an animal that's meant to be, pure. The life that's standing in my place is a life of purity. That's what's required to make this offering, that it be pure. And then the blood. We talk more about the blood because I think it's Leviticus 17 on the Day of Atonement. It talks more about the power of the blood. But the blood is used in this offering, and it can do what it does because God says life is in the blood, and life is what's required to make these payments and to work these changes that the offerings do. But this offering, the burnt offering, is listed first of the five, and that's because it serves as a foundation for all the others. And what's noteworthy about this is this offering, it makes atonement. This is not the offering that you make like when you sin and now you need to go make a burnt offering. That's not what it's for. Instead, it's about this pleasing aroma that you're offering to the Lord so that you can be accepted into his presence. In the other offerings, when an animal is killed, part of it is burned, part of it is separated to be burned on the altar, but many of the other valuable parts of the animal are kept and used. Right? Some of it is kept for the priests in the peace offering. Some of it is kept for the person who's making the offering, and they get to eat from it as well. The burnt offering, nothing is kept. All of it is given to God. It is an act of total surrender, everything to him, nothing kept, nothing held back, which people might look at this kind of offering and go, like, that's kind of wasteful, you know? Like, I could have used some of that. Like, did we have to get rid of all of it? Like, why can't we use some of it? It's interesting, but there is a parallel from this offering to the New Testament, the woman who breaks the ointment over Jesus and anoints him before his death. And the disciples see that and they go, well, that's such a waste. You know, we could have sold this for a bunch of money. We could have used this for God. We could have done this. And Jesus goes, stop it. You know, stop it. What she did is beautiful for me. And he actually calls it this kind of offering, this kind of full surrender offering that is the ascension offering. This is what he links it to. It's the foundation for worship of God because it shows that you need this full surrender. And it even gives us an image of like what it is we have to go through in order to come to God, in order to be in his holy presence. It's called the ascension offering because the animal that is standing in your place, that is killed, is put on the fire, and from the fire it is burned up, and the animal is really kind of transformed into the smoke that then rises to heaven. It rises to be in God's presence. Like, that's the image that you're getting. And in the same way, we need to, if we want to do that, if we want to be with God, go through this kind of like purging fire, death to self that burns away the life that we had and changes and transforms us so that we can be brought into the presence of God. And in doing that, experience this new life, this true life with him. Now, they offer an animal because they can't do that themselves, right? Like, we can't survive that, and we're not unblemished, we're not pure, and so we can't even perform the same function that the animal itself does. This offering was made daily at the temple. So Leviticus chapter 6, there's further instructions about it. The Lord spoke to Moses saying, command Aaron and his sons, the priests, saying, this is the law of the burnt offering. The burnt offering shall be on the hearth, on the altar, all night until the morning, and the fire of the altar shall be kept burning on it. It was offered twice a day, once in the morning and once in the evening. And it's a reminder for the people of God, a daily reminder in this image of total surrender that in order to go into God's presence, this is what it is. This is what it looks like. This is what it requires. It happens through death. And this is this foundation that's being laid for the people of Israel to understand their relationship with God and what's required to be in his holy presence. And so now I'll ask you, what is it that you are surrendering your life to right now? Like, what's the thing that you're giving yourself to? What are you giving your life to? What are you holding nothing back from? And whatever that thing is, I mean, that is the thing that's most important to you. But is it worth it? Is it worth giving everything to? Is it worth surrendering everything to? Moving on to the second offering, this is the grain offering. It's chapter 2, verse 1. When anyone brings a grain offering as an offering to the Lord, his offering shall be of fine flour. He shall pour oil on it and put frankincense on it and bring it to Aaron's sons, the priests, and he shall take from it a handful of the fine flour and oil with all of its frankincense, and the priest shall burn this as a memorial portion on the altar, a food offering with a pleasing aroma to the Lord. But the rest of the grain offering shall be for Aaron and his sons. It is the most holy part of the Lord's food offerings. If you know your Bible, you know we've seen something like this before in Genesis chapter 4, the very beginning of the Bible, the offering that Cain makes from the produce that he's grown and produced. There are more details in this if you read Leviticus 2 that you might kind of set off some flags for you and go, well, that sounds significant. So like this offering is meant to be given with no leaven, supposed to be unleavened. And we know that the metaphorical meaning that's given to unleavened means it's pure. There's nothing mixed into it. There's nothing extra to it. And it's supposed to always be given with salt. Salt was the main food preservative in the ancient world. It's still a preservative. It's still in all of our stuff. And salt, the metaphorical meaning, especially we see this in the New Testament, has to do with God's preserving grace. But a handful of that is set aside to be burned on the altar, and the rest of it is given to the priests. We're going to learn more about the priests next week. They are the mediators between God and man, and it's a high calling. They have a high standard. They're called to a high standard, and so we'll see in Leviticus just how high that standard is, but they have to. They dedicate their lives to it, and this is everything. This is their whole role, their whole life. They don't have, you know, the time that everyone else in Israel has to go grow some crops and raise some livestock or develop a trade or whatever. Like, they don't do those things. And so this is a way that God has provided for them to eat, you know, to be provided and taken care of through something like this. This is not a mandatory offering. There's no instruction in the law that says, and now you have to make the grain offering. This is an optional free will offering that people make in gratitude to God. You know, if the burnt offering is about saying, I'm fully surrendered and I'm giving myself entirely to God, the grain offering is saying, thank you, God, for everything that you've given to me. It's a recognition of everything that God gives to me. It's a similar line of thought to the tithe, right? Give 10% of everything that you produce and that you have to God. It's a similar line of thought, but it is separate and distinct. And so this would be above and beyond that. And Deuteronomy 26 actually talks a little bit further about the grain offering. It says this, "And behold, now I bring the first of the fruit of the ground, which you, O Lord, have given me, and you shall set it down before the Lord your God and worship before the Lord your God, and you shall rejoice in all the good that the Lord your God has given to you and to your house, you and the Levite and the sojourner who is among you." See that? Rejoice in all the good God has given you. Right? God has given you 100% of what you have. 100% of what you have is his grace and his gift to you. And like, I know that that could sound like, well, you don't know my life, you know, or like, well, you don't know how hard I worked. You don't know how smart I had to be. You don't know what decisions I made. And like, that's true. But I know that God made your body and gave strength to your body. And God put the brain that you have in your head. And that God is the one who gives the sun and the rain to the fields for the harvest. Like, everything is from him. He's the creator. He's the source. It's all from him. Everything that we have is from him. This is recognition that thank you for giving me 100% of what I have. I'm going to separate and dedicate some of this to you in this act of gratitude. Do you have gratitude? Some people don't. I know you know some people who don't. Maybe you don't. Like, there are some miserable people out there. And like, I don't want to like smile and laugh at people who are miserable, but like, there are people who can't appreciate the things that they have. Like, whatever it is that they have, it's never enough, or it's never good enough, and there is none of that gratitude. There is none of that appreciation, and some of that is comparison and comparing yourself to people who have more, have better. Do you have gratitude? If you have gratitude, how do you express your gratitude? Do you do anything? Do you do anything to express gratitude? Or is it just everything I have? It's not enough. Need more. Can't take time out of my busy life to express gratitude. Moving on. The third offering is the peace offering, sometimes called the fellowship offering. And chapter 3 describes it, gives the same sort of mechanics as before in chapter 1. What's different in chapter 3 is that the animal is not entirely put on the altar. Part of it is separated to be put on the altar, and then part of it is separated for the priest. Part of it is separated for the person who's giving it. And then we read this in chapter 7 about the peace offering. Verse 11, "And this is the law of the sacrifice of peace offerings that one may offer to the Lord. If he offers it for thanksgiving, then he shall offer it with the thanksgiving sacrifice, unleavened loaves mixed with oil, unleavened wafers smeared with oil, loaves of fine flour well mixed with oil. With the sacrifices of his peace offerings for thanksgiving, he shall bring his offering with loaves of leavened bread And there it shall, and from it he shall offer one loaf from each offering as a gift to the Lord. It shall belong to the priest who throws the blood of the peace offerings, and the flesh of the sacrifice of his peace offerings for thanksgiving shall be eaten on the day of his offering. He shall not leave any of it until the morning. It's called the peace offering because the purpose of this offering, it's not so much about making peace with God as it is about in enjoying the peace that God gives to us and offers to us. And it is true, the only way that you kind of enter into this peace with God is through the sacrifice of the peace offering. There still needs to be this substitutionary death that you move through. But like the grain offering, this is an optional thing. It is a Thanksgiving offering, and it's really about sharing a meal with God. Right? It's about sitting down at a table and sharing a meal with God. The priest is there as God's representative, and then there's you, and then part of the portion is burned to God, an aroma to him. And this is like an occasion, right? This is not like a solemn, like, I'm going to go offer the peace offering, I'll be back tomorrow. Like, this is like a party when you do a peace offering. It's like, it's not even a stretch to think of it like maybe a block party would be, or a cookout where just like you're bringing people to it. You know, when you're having a peace offering, you say to your neighbor, like, hey, I'm having a peace offering. You want to come? You want to come be part of it? Like, hey, mom, like, I'm having a peace offering. Make sure you come out. Like, you bring people into this and they all participate in it as well. I don't know the last time that you have witnessed a whole animal be like butchered and divided up in front of you. I've never seen it, but I do know how big they are. There's a lot of food on that thing. Like, that is not, you can't finish that with just two people, the priest and like you who's bringing it. No, you're meant to bring people in on this, and they all celebrate the peace offering together. I mean, God says, eat it all on the first day. Like, that's a lot. And then like a few verses down, he goes, you can use 3 days, but 3 days is the limit. You can't go beyond 3 days. The peace offering is about, it's like getting a piece of the Garden of Eden back. It's like stepping into the garden for a moment again, where in the garden we got to be in God's presence. And it, again, it's happening through the sacrifice. That's what's enabling it, but you can have it. It's about being in God's presence and enjoying all the good gifts that God gives us with God. That's what the peace offering is doing. Because of sin, you know, we don't get to do that. We don't just have that peace always living in us. It's a problem that Israelites in Leviticus are having, but God makes a way. He makes a way to enjoy peace with him again. Where do you get your peace? Do you ever feel at peace? Yeah, that's a better question. God makes a way for us to have peace with him. Two offerings to go. Number four is the sin offering, sometimes called the purification offering. Chapter 4 says this, "And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the people of Israel, saying, if anyone sins unintentionally in any of the Lord's commandments about the things not to be done and does any of them." So that is what occasions this. What occasions the sin offering, the purification offering, is sin. When you sin, you break a command. And the distinction is made an unintentional sin. So this is not like, I'm very clear about God's rules, I'm very clear about the law, and I don't care, I'm going to break it anyways. This is different than that, and Moses' law deals differently with that. This is like, you know, you become aware of it. You become aware like, oh, you know what? That was really not right of me to do that. Or like, I wasn't really thinking about it in the moment, but I regret this thing, and now I need to go and rectify it. We talked about last week how sin has this polluting, contaminating effect, right? Like, when you sin, it's not just your sin. It doesn't just stay like this small thing, but it sticks to you, and then it spreads out from you, and it sticks to other things around you. And it can't be allowed in God's holy presence. If sin was allowed in God's holy presence, it's not holy anymore. God's presence can't be there anymore because it's no longer holy. Or the sinful, unclean thing would just be consumed in fire. Like, there is no reconciliation there. This offering is a means to remove the pollution, to cleanse it, to purify it. That's why it's called the purification offering. And this is the one that is used, and we see this in many of the instructions throughout Leviticus when someone is in a ritually unclean state. You become ritually unclean. Well, whole sermon in the future on this, but through contact with those polluted associations with sin, like death is associated with sin, sickness and disease is associated, like those things will make you unclean, and to become ritually clean again, the sin offering is part of that process. But there is nuance to it, and I do want to look at this in Leviticus 4. And so verse 3 says this, if it is the anointed priest who sins, thus bringing guilt on the people, then he shall offer for the sin that he has committed a bull from the herd without blemish to the Lord for a sin offering. He shall bring the bull to the entrance of the tent of meeting before the Lord, lay his hand on the head of the bull, and kill the bull before the Lord. And the anointed priest shall take some of the blood of the bull and bring it into the tent of meeting. And the priest shall dip his finger in the blood and sprinkle part of the blood seven times before the Lord in front of the veil of the sanctuary. And there are more details and mechanics after that. But the first thing Moses does and God does in giving this law about the sin offering is he puts the priests on blast. They're first. They're target number one. Here's what you do when the priest makes a whoopsie and brings guilt on everyone. And it's a big deal. It's a big deal. His sin, he brings guilt on everyone because of the role that he's in, right? If he messes up with the holy things, if he messes up with the teaching of God's word, it's a big deal. And so in this sacrifice, the blood is actually brought into the tabernacle, into the tent of meeting, and is sprinkled there for cleansing. And then chapter 4 continues, and it says, here's what you do when the whole congregation sins unintentionally. You've all got something wrong, and now you've become aware of it, and you need to repent. And it's the same thing. The blood is brought into the tent. And then the instruction is given for, here's what you do when a leader sins unintentionally. A leader sins, and you make the sin offering. But in this sin offering, the blood is not brought into the tent. It's just thrown on the altar. And then the instruction for when an ordinary person sins. Same thing. Blood's not brought into the tent. It's just thrown on the altar. And the effect of this sin offering, we read in verse 26, the end of verse 26 says, so the priest shall make atonement for him for his sin, and he shall be forgiven. What chapter 4 tells us, one of the things chapter 4 tells us, is that the polluting effect of sin, it always happens. There's always contamination. There's always a stain. But there's a greater amount of pollution the higher up the responsibility ladder you go, right? There's more influence up there. There's more impact. It spreads further. It sticks to more. And we all know that intuitively, I think, but it is something that you should sometimes think about. You know, like parents should think about, like, it's not just my sin. What is the impact that my sin has on my kids? Like any leader in the church, leading a group or a team or leading the church, you should think, what is the impact, what is the effect of my sin on the church and the people that I'm with? In this sacrifice, part of the animal is eaten, but only when the blood is thrown just on the altar, when the blood is brought into the tabernacle, it's like such a bigger and more serious deal that the whole animal is burned up. The main purpose of this offering is the purifying effect from the blood of the sacrifice to cleanse, you know, to clean up, to purify the cloud of pollution, to wash out the stains that sin leaves on us and all the places that it gets. And it's also meant to purify the tabernacle itself. It's saying, like, your sin is polluting and contaminating the holy area that God is, and so we need to make sure that is cleansed and made right. The image that we get from this offering is, again, you place your hand on the animal. That it's the stain, the pollution, the uncleanness. It's being given over to the animal, and then it is killed and dies in your place. And then through the animal's blood, this unblemished, pure animal, the purity of that blood and that life is the thing that has the power to cleanse and cover you, and to cleanse and cover the area where God's presence is. And again, it only happens through this death. This is not something we can do ourselves. Like, we can't get the stains out. We can't clean the pollution up. What's that scene in Macbeth? You guys know Shakespeare, huh? High school? Macbeth, when Lady Macbeth is like sleepwalking and she's washing her hands and she's like shouting about the stain on her hands because she feels the guilt for the part that she had in the death of King Duncan. You guys remember. That's us. That's us. Like, you're washing it. You want to get it out, but you can't get it out. You can't get rid of it because you can't undo your sin. You can't undo the thing that you did. And so you can't get rid of it. The writer of Hebrews is talking about why all this blood, why all this death is necessary. Hebrews chapter 9, verse 22, indeed, under the law, this is Leviticus, this is right where we are, almost everything is purified with blood, and without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness of sins. That is the payment. That's the thing that gets the stain off of us. We can't use our own blood, for one. You need it, you know? You need your blood. Don't know if you know that. But also, we're not the pure and unblemished animal. Like, our blood is not, it doesn't meet the standard to be used for this purpose. We can't do this ourselves. Now, on to the fifth and final offering, the guilt offering. We read this in chapter 5. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, if anyone commits a breach of faith and sins unintentionally in any of the holy things of the Lord, he shall bring to the Lord as his compensation a ram without blemish out of the flock, valued in silver shekels according to the shekel of the sanctuary, for a guilt offering. So the temple determines the worth. He shall also make restitution for what he has done amiss in the holy things, and shall add a fifth to it and give it to the priest. And the priest shall make atonement for him with the ram of the guilt offering, and he shall be forgiven. The guilt offering is all to do about making payment. It is making payment for the debt that we owe caused by our sin and paying restitution. And the first example here, and this is what forgiveness is. Like, the whole concept of forgiveness arises out of, like, someone owes you money and you forgive the debt. Like, that's what forgiveness is. There's a debt that exists, and then it is cleared. And what's happening in this first example that would occasion the guilt offering is sin about the holy things of the Lord. And so probably, most likely, you didn't realize you were in an unclean state, but you are, and then you did something you weren't supposed to do. And so now you've become guilty concerning the holy things of the Lord. Or, like, there's instructions about where you can go and where you can't go around, like, the tabernacle. Maybe you didn't know something, you made a mistake. But it creates this debt, and the debt has to be paid. And it's not the only occasion. And so there are more times that you would make the guilt offering. And so in chapter 6, in verse 1, we read this: the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, if anyone sins and commits a breach of faith against the Lord by deceiving his neighbor in a matter of deposit or security or through robbery, or if he has oppressed his neighbor or has found something lost and lied about it, swearing falsely, and any of all the things that people do and sin their mind. So this is the other thing that would occasion the guilt offering. And again, this is helping us understand the cost of sin, the debt that sin creates. It's not just about polluting, you know, the pollution or the stains that are sticking to you that need to be purified. There's also a debt that has to be paid. So not only, in this offering, not only are you offering an animal as a sacrifice, which in itself, like, they don't have banks. They do have currency, but the main way that their wealth is, like, represented is in the flocks that they had, in the livestock, and the resources they had. And so to give one of those because you sin, that's already a loss, right, from your wealth. And not only that, you take whatever it is valued at, you add 20% to it, and you have to give that. That's when you sin in the holy things. The sin is only really directly against God. When you sin against a person, and I love the way this is phrased, it's you sin against God by deceiving your neighbor. So like you deceive your neighbor, but God says, you know what? You're really sinning against me here and your neighbor. When you sin against a person, no one's just a person. Every person bears the image of God. God's made all of us in his image. And so to sin against them is to sin against the image of God. And so God is always going to take offense to that. God is always going to understand that it is a sin against him because you are not loving and respecting this thing that he's created in his image. So now you have to pay back whatever it is that you took or like cheated or got from underhanded methods, like whatever it is, you pay that back in full to the person. You also add 20% on top of that to give to that person. And then you take yourself to the temple and you make your offering of the ram. And then you add 20% on top of that to the temple. Like sin quickly gets very expensive. You know, like Satan has done his best job that he could possibly do in trying to convince as many people as possible, sin is not a big deal. You know, sin is a small thing. It's a cheap thing. It doesn't matter that much. Why doesn't everyone just lighten up about it? Why can't you just get over it? Like, come on, grow up. Satan's a liar. But it's a lie that people buy because they want to buy it. Tell that to someone who's been hurt by sin. Tell them, it's not a big deal. Just need to get over it. Grow up. What a cold and unloving thing to say to this person who's been hurt by sin. God is not cold and unloving, so he can never say that. He can never say, it's not a big deal. Just get over it. I'll just let this one go. He can't do that. He can't do that and be loving at the same time. And that's good that God is loving like that, but it's also a problem for us because we're sinners. We owe the debt, and God can't just let it go. But God, in his love for us, what he does is even while we're sinners, he makes a way. He makes a way for us for this payment to be made, the debt to be settled, and for us to still live. And it's not ideal, like what we see in the Levitical law, it's not ideal. Because it's not permanent, it doesn't treat and fix the root problem, but it does make payment for what is owed so that you can actually be forgiven. And really, all five of these offerings, this whole sacrificial system is set up because God is making a way for us. He makes a way for us. I mean, he didn't have to. He does it because he loves us. He makes a way for us to deal with our sin and be restored to some type of relationship with him. And getting to dwell near his holy presence. But it's a lot of work. It can be done, but it's a lot of work. It takes a lot of death. It takes a lot of blood. It's expensive. It takes a lot of priests. But it works. It works, or at least it works until we get to Jesus. Because Jesus came to fulfill the law. Last week mentioned in Hebrews chapter 10 that Jesus made the perfect offering one time for all time. All the other offerings are made daily and repeatedly at the temple, day in and day out, year after year, and there's no end to them. Jesus gets up, he makes one offering, one time for all time, the perfect offering. As at the very beginning of the sermon, we haven't really evolved past the sacrificial system. We still need it. It's just that the sacrifice has already been made. It's been made by Jesus. And we're still living and depending on what he has done for us. I mean, what Jesus does in the good news of the gospel, he does exactly what we see the offerings in Leviticus do. First, he takes our place, right? He's standing in our place. It should be us. What happens to Jesus should happen to us, but he goes in our place. The burnt offering, the full surrender, Jesus fully surrenders himself. He holds nothing back. He gives everything entirely to God so that through him and the sacrifice, we can be accepted. The grain offering, everything God has given to us, Jesus gives himself to us. And the first fruits of the works, my blood of the covenant that's poured out for the forgiveness of sins. And we get to share in this meal with Jesus at peace with God through the sacrifice that he made. The sin offering, Jesus' blood, is the thing that cleanses us, that purifies us, that washes the stain of sin off of us. Because our sin is given to him on the cross. The guilt offering, Jesus pays the debt. He makes the payment for the debt that we owe because of our sin, and he pays it in full. And Jesus, he can do it because he is unblemished. He is pure. He's sinless. He's never sinned. He's fully God and fully man. And because of this righteous, perfect life that he lives on our behalf, he is now sufficient to be this offering for us and to be this offering in such a way that it's stronger and more powerful and more final than any offering in the Levitical system ever could be. Of course, his blood is going to be stronger and more powerful than the blood of rams and goats and bulls. He's the Son of God. And that offering does for us what we see in the image of the burnt offering, right? Because there is a part for us in this. The burnt offering, the image is an image of surrender and giving ourselves entirely to God. That's how we make response to what Jesus has done for us. Jesus died for us, but now we also are dying to ourselves in him. Like our old way of life, our old selves, we're putting that to death in Jesus. And that decision we make that says, I trust Jesus. I'm going to follow Jesus. I'm going to depend entirely on Jesus. My old self is put to death. And just like through that death, the animal's transformed into the smoke. Like Jesus is resurrected. Through his death, Jesus is resurrected and ascends to the throne in heaven. And that same resurrection, that same rising, that new life is the life that he gives to you and me. That's the life that he plants in your heart that's growing right now today. One thing that I really love and appreciate about Leviticus is it makes so clear to us, you know, no one can make their own way to God. That's not what Leviticus is. It's not like, all right, guys, let's try to figure out a way so that we can make our way to God and he'll accept us and you try that over there and I'll try this. And like, oh, maybe there are a bunch of methods we can use and they all kind of lead to the same place. Like God says, no, I'm going to make the method for you. And it's the option that you have. God makes a way for us. It's through death. It's through blood, there must be sacrifice. There must be payment made. But he makes a way. And now Jesus arrives and he says, I'm the way. I'm the way. You can know God through Jesus. You could be forgiven. You could be set free. You could have peace. You could be reconciled to God through Jesus. You could be cleansed. The stains can be removed. You could be changed through Jesus. I hope that you know, I hope you're growing in the knowledge of everything Jesus has done for you, everything that he is for you. Just how great his love is for you, just how far it goes. And if you haven't taken it yet, if you haven't made him your way yet, you can. He made this offering for you. It could be for you. And you could be restored to God through him. Let me pray for us. God, thank you that